College Golfer of the Year for the 1995-96 season at the annual Fred Haskins Award Dinner during the tournament. But instead of attending, Tiger went home. More than 200 guests were in town for the dinner, which had to be canceled. Once again, John Feinstein pounced. When you are the game's next one, and you know your presence in a tournament has been promoted, you really should show up, he wrote. And when the sponsors of a major college golf award have scheduled their awards dinner to suit you at a time and place where you have told them you will be, you don't blow off the dinner and go home. Tiger couldn't stand Feinstein, and he had no trouble dismissing him. But he also received unexpected criticism from fellow pros, which he couldn't shrug off. Tom Kite said he couldn't remember being tired when he was 20. Peter Jacobson said it was no longer appropriate to compare Tiger to Nicklaus and Palmer because they never walked out on people. The words that stung the most came from Palmer himself. Tiger should have played, Palmer told a reporter. He should have gone to the dinner. The lesson is you don't make commitments you can't fulfill unless you're on your deathbed. I thought those people were my friends, Tiger thought after reading the barrage of criticism. Alone and feeling like a target, he suddenly missed Stanford and the cocoon that it had provided. Everyone was beating him up for pulling out of a tournament and skipping a dinner, but no one knew what he was dealing with back home. For 20 years, his entire life, he and his parents had lived together in the same house in Cyprus. But now Tiger had moved out and his parents were splitting up. John Merchant had been tasked with finding a new home for Kaltita, one that was big enough to accommodate her relatives when they visited from Thailand. He had located a 4,500-square-foot house with 5 bedrooms and 6 baths in a gated community in Tustin, California, for $700,000. Tiger had agreed to pay for it, and the closing had been set for early November. The situation between his parents was more bewildering than anything he was encountering on the tour, but he wasn't about to admit that. Better to just take the heat for bailing at the last minute. On October 6th, 1 week after skipping the Haskins dinner, Tiger won his first PGA Tour event, outdueling Davis Love III at the Las Vegas Invitational. The pace of his success was mind-boggling. In just his 5th PGA tournament, he had emerged victorious. "Did you ever see yourself doing this so soon?" a journalist asked. "Yeah," Tiger said matter-of-factly. "I kinda did." Hughes Norton pointed to the win as proof that Tiger had done the right thing by bowing out of the Buick Challenge, but that didn't change the fact that he'd left sponsors and hundreds of people high and dry, or assuaged the hard feelings because of it. One of the hardest things for Tiger to do was admit wrongdoing and apologize, but something had to be done. Golf writer Pete McDaniel, who was working with Earl on his forthcoming book about raising Tiger, was assigned to ghostwrite an apology for Woods. No golf writer knew more about the history of African Americans in golf than McDaniel. And although Tiger wasn't the first black golfer, he was the first game changer, the one who was shattering the glass ceiling. With that in mind, McDaniel was eager to help Woods navigate the rough waters. He crafted an apology, and it appeared under Tiger's byline in a column published in Golf World days after his win in Vegas. "I didn't even think about the dinner," it read. "I realize now that what I did was wrong. Even though I know I did the right thing in getting away, I should have stayed long enough to attend the dinner and then go home. But hindsight is 20/20. The piece did the trick. The people in charge of the Fred Haskins Award Banquet rescheduled it for early November, and Tiger and Earl flew back to Georgia to attend. Tiger was gracious and humble in his acceptance remarks, but Earl's introductory speech left a much bigger impression. Choking back tears, he said, "Please forgive me. But sometimes I get very emotional when I talk about my son. My heart fills with so much joy when I realize that this young man is going to be able to help so many people. He will transcend this game and bring to the world a humanitarianism which has never been known before. The world will be a better place to live in by virtue of his existence and his presence. I acknowledge only a small part in that I know I was personally selected by God himself to nurture this young man and bring him to the point where he can make his contribution to humanity. This is my treasure. Please accept it and use it wisely. Thank you." The entire audience rose to its feet in applause as Tiger put his arms around his father. Tiger was still smarting from the fallout of missing the Haskins dinner when he won his 2nd PGA Tour event, beating Payne Stewart head-to-head to win the Walt Disney World Oldsmobile Classic by one stroke. The $216,000 purse raised Woods' earnings to $734,794 in his extremely shortened season, qualifying him for the 1997 tour. Remarkably, he had won two of his first seven professional tournaments. After his obligatory press conference, however, he was in no mood to talk to reporters in a less formal setting. When a few of them trailed him to the locker room in hopes of getting a few more quotes, Tiger instructed the security guards not to allow any media inside, and the press was promptly told to leave. But under PGA Tour rules, the locker room had to be accessible to the press. Wes Seeley, who was in charge of PR for the tour, told security to open it. "The tour makes the rules, not the kid," Seeley said. "Regardless of what he and his people think, he's not the fifth Beatle." But he had become the rock star of golf. His fame was transforming the game and wreaking havoc on the rules of etiquette at tournaments. The crowds at his first seven tour events were twice, or in some instances, three times the normal size. Fans were trampling over the ropes to get to him. Women were approaching him on the range and proposing marriage. More than once, he had to escape the clubhouse after playing to evade overzealous spectators. David Letterman and Jay Leno were clamoring to have him on their shows. Bill Cosby was willing to compose an episode of The Cosby Show around Tiger just to get him to appear on the top sitcom on television. GQ was offering to put him on the cover. Pepsi was ready to put up big money for him to film a commercial. Everyone, it seemed, wanted a piece of Tiger. It had gotten to the point that whenever he saw Norton approaching, he knew that this guy or that guy wanted to know when they could interview him. "Tell him to kiss my ass," he would tell Norton. "All right," Norton would say. "And after that, what should I tell them? Tell him to kiss my ass again." By the time he arrived in Tulsa, Oklahoma for the Players' Championship at the end of October, Tiger had it with all the pestering and intrusiveness of the press. Nobody realized this more than Earl, who was traveling with him. On the evening after the first round, Earl was in his hotel suite enjoying a cigarette when Newsweek senior writer John McCormick knocked on the door, introduced himself, and talked his way inside. But after explaining that his magazine wanted to do a feature on him and Tiger and put them on the cover, McCormick hit a wall. Earl said he wasn't interested, which meant Tiger wasn't interested. Determined to change Earl's mind, McCormick pulled out his wallet. "Look," he told Earl, "I'm going to show you the reason I really want to do this story." "Money?" Earl said. "No, this," McCormick said, removing the photograph of his two little boys and handing it to Earl. "That's why." Earl had developed a soft spot for children. Despite being wary, he ended up talking to McCormick for 3 hours, filling the reporter's notebook with plenty of quotes and anecdotes about Tiger. It was midnight by the time McCormick finally left Earl's room. About 2 hours later, Tiger was awakened by a phone call from his mother, who informed him that Earl had just been taken to the hospital in an ambulance after experiencing chest pain. Roughly 10 years later, Earl had undergone a quadruple bypass in response to arteriosclerosis stemming from cholesterol buildup. Knowing his father's history, Tiger went directly to the hospital where doctors had administered an EKG and given Earl medication to stabilize the situation. "It'll be okay," he told Tiger. "Don't worry about it. Go on out and play." Tiger didn't say anything, but he was too worried about the health of his 64-year-old father to concentrate on golf. After spending the rest of the night at the hospital, Tiger shot a 78 the next day, his worst round since turning pro. "I didn't want to be here today," he said afterward, "because there are more important things in life than golf. I love my dad to death, and I wouldn't want to see anything happen to him." He ended up finishing the tournament tied for 21st at 8 over par. Weeks later, he visited Earl in Cyprus. While Tiger was in town, Earl agreed to another interview with McCormick. This time he went to Earl's home, where he hoped to also talk to Tiger. 10 minutes, he told Earl, would suffice. Without making any promises, Earl called Tiger and handed the phone to McCormick, who made his pitch. "No," Tiger told McCormick. "Okay, just to be clear," McCormick said, "this is a story about your dad and how he raised you. I'm not trying to do a cover story about you." "No," repeated Tiger. McCormick was taken aback. He wasn't unpleasant, McCormick recalled. It was just, no. Although Tiger wasn't interested in being on the cover of another national magazine, his corporate sponsors liked the idea, so he reluctantly agreed to pose with Earl for a Newsweek photographer. A few weeks later, they appeared on the cover together, Tiger wearing Nike gear and holding a Titleist golf club, Earl wearing a Titleist hat under the headline, "Raising a Tiger, the family story behind golf's $60 million prodigy." The 9-page article portrayed Tiger as so gracious that he signs autographs for half an hour after tourney rounds and gives clinics to inner-city kids. It also claimed, without any evidence, that Tiger had endured years of racist treatment at golf courses. But the thrust of the story arose from a question. How did the parents pull it off? In other words, How did Erlen Kultida raise such a fine young man? Every move has been calculated to make him the best person he can be, Earl told Newsweek. You have your priorities. Your priority is the welfare of the child first. Who he is and what is going to make him a good person has priority over making him a good athlete. Earl's comments were self-serving, but from a marketing standpoint, Nike and Titleist could not have been happier. Even the photographs taken by Newsweek were carefully staged to feature Nike gear and Titleist equipment while simultaneously projecting Tiger and his family as idyllic. One image in particular portrayed Earl and Kultida standing side by side, smiling, arms around each other as if in a state of marital bliss. It was taken outside the family home in Cyprus, which Kultida had just moved out of to live on her own. Although he never talked to Newsweek, Tiger was always willing to do everything his powerful sponsors wanted from him. But there won't be much more of that, Tiger said at the time. I have no desire to be the king of endorsement money. IMG, however, was determined to change his mind. Tiger knew he needed advice on what to do with his money. He also knew that finance and investment strategy weren't his father's strong suits. Instead, Tiger turned to John Merchant, whom he was looking to more and more for advice. Merchant's first call was to his old friend Giles Payne, a superb attorney specializing in estate planning and trusts. Payne had been responsible for getting Merchant onto the USGA Executive Committee, and Merchant couldn't think of anyone more qualified than Payne and his partners at Brody Wilkinson, a boutique law firm based in Southport, Connecticut, to guide Tiger through the complicated opportunities and pitfalls presented by instant wealth. Payne and his law partners, Seth O.L. Brody and Fritz Ober, both of whom were also exceptionally skilled, began working with Tiger right after he turned pro. On November 19, 1996, the firm created Tiger Woods, Inc., a Connecticut-based nonprofit that designated Tiger as chairman and Earl as president. Weeks later, Tiger's new team of Connecticut lawyers were summoned to Florida to meet with him and his corporate partners, Nike and Titleist. The group arrived at Bay Hill Club and Lodge in Orlando, feeling triumphant. The joint marketing influence of both companies was paying off in spades. In addition to the Newsweek cover story, Nike had just aired another Tour de Force commercial written by Riswold, I Am Tiger Woods, that featured one child after another, most of them minorities, staring into the camera while repeating the phrase, I am Tiger Woods. With everything clicking, Tiger and his team planned to spend 2 days mapping out plans for how to fund Tiger's newly formed nonprofit, as well as discussing ways to use it as a vehicle to expand golfing opportunities among minority youth. Before getting down to business, the group played around. Tiger was paired with John Merchant, and they joked and ribbed each other for 18 holes. Tiger could not have been happier with Merchant's contribution during his transition from amateur to pro. Merchant had been watching Tiger's back at every crucial step, and he had brought in a team of financial and legal advisors that Tiger fully trusted. As a gesture of how much he respected Merchant, Tiger asked him to run the strategy session that was scheduled for later that evening. It was a responsibility that Merchant gladly accepted. After all, he had handpicked half the men who would be seated around the table. But after leaving the course, Merchant first met up with Earl for a drink. Both men were feeling on top of the world. One drink led to a second, and then a third. Before long, they had each downed 5 martinis. By the time Merchant and Earl wandered into the conference room for the appointed 6 p.m. strategy session, both were hammered. Merchant found his seat between Wally Uehlein, the CEO of AccuSnet Company, corporate parent of Titleist, and Craig Bowen, the first African-American sales rep for Titleist. Merchant had introduced Tiger to Earl and Bowen back when Tiger was still in high school, and that introduction had gone a long way towards cementing Tiger's decision to sign with Titleist. It had also paved the way for Titleist to help write the bylaws of Tiger Woods Incorporated. Others at the table included Phil Knight, Fritz Ober, Giles Payne, whom Merchant affectionately referred to as Tiger's money man, and Earl. Once everyone was present, Merchant opened the meeting by talking about Nike, which was going to help fund Tiger's foundation with $1 million of his $40 million contract. But Merchant, his tongue loosened by alcohol, objected when he learned that Earl would be in charge of overseeing the distribution of the money for junior golf efforts. As far as Merchant was concerned, putting Earl in charge of $1 million was a license to steal. This is not how it should be, he boomed. I don't give a shit how important Earl is. He can't deal with junior golf all by his damn self. Just because Nike throws money at him, that ain't gonna get it done. Earl could take that money and spend it. A deafening silence fell over the group. Instead of spelling out his vision for how to help advance the cause of minority golf in the United States, Merchant had created an incredibly awkward situation. The meeting was abruptly adjourned. Without saying a word, Tiger got up to leave. Craig Bowen followed him out. "Tiger," he said, "you all right?" "No, I'm not all right. I know my dad, and I know John. This is not going to be good." It was obvious that Merchant and Earl had both had too much to drink. The thinking was that it would be better for them to sleep it off and get a fresh start the next day. But there were two things about Lieutenant Colonel Earl Woods that were in play. He never remembered to say thank you, and he never forgot a slight. He had a very cold, ruthless side. Tiger once said that his father could slit your throat and then sit down and eat his dinner. When everyone reconvened in the conference room the following morning, there was a table with breakfast food. Refreshed, Merchant set his briefcase down in his seat between Bowen and Ueline and headed to the table for a cup of coffee. Earl intercepted him and asked him to step outside the room. Then he fired Merchant. Dumbfounded, Merchant just stared at his friend. After all they'd been through together? After all the money he'd raised to finance Tiger's amateur career? After all the pro bono work and all the trouble he'd been through with the state of Connecticut? After everything he'd done to set up Tiger with the lawyers from Brody Wilkinson? What the fuck? "It's one of the hardest things I've ever had to do," Earl said, feigning pain. "Why?" Merchant whispered. Earl said nothing. "What's the problem?" Merchant pressed. Still nothing. Merchant felt like the room was spinning. He couldn't get his bearings. Effective immediately, he was no longer Tiger's attorney. Without saying another word, both men returned to the conference room. Earl sat down and ate his breakfast, while Merchant picked up his briefcase and walked out. Within an hour, he had checked out of his room and left for the airport. It was an awkward situation for Merchant's trusted friends Giles Payne and Fritz Ober, but they took over all of Tiger's legal and business affairs. As Tiger's new personal attorneys, they stepped in right away and helped execute a deed that transferred a property in Isleworth from IMG to Tiger, listing Tiger's mailing address as 135 Reynolds Drive, Southport, Connecticut, the address of his new law firm. They would also go on to establish the Tiger Woods Revocable Trust, which named Earl and Tiger the sole trustees. Retaining Brody Wilkinson was the single most important piece of advice that Merchant ever gave to Tiger. The firm would go on to handle Tiger's resources for decades, enabling him to build a vast fortune and avoid the mistakes made by so many celebrated athletes who earn millions in their early 20s only to end up broke after retirement. 2 weeks later, Merchant received an envelope in the mail from Earl. It contained a check for 2 weeks' severance pay. He sent it back with a message, "Shove it up your ass." Merchant figured he would never get to the bottom of what had truly motivated Earl to fire him. But months later, he ran into Cultita at a golf tournament. The two of them had always gotten along well, and she seemed truly remorseful that he was no longer a part of Tiger's life. In a private conversation, she confided her thoughts on the matter, namely, that Tiger had always listened to Earl. His whole life was listening to Dad, and suddenly, he had started to listen to somebody else on matters of finance and investments. The competition bothered Earl. "The parent always wins," Cultita told Merchant. Merchant never heard from Tiger again. The last words Tiger ever said to him were spoken as they were walking off the 18th green at Bay Hill, when Tiger looked at him, smiled, and said, "I love you, man." Chapter 11. Masterful. On a sunny Monday morning, Tiger Woods was inside his mother's new luxury home in Tustin, California. It was January 13, 1997, and a shiny new Mercedes was parked in the driveway. Tiger had won it, along with $216,000 in first-place prize money the day before at the Mercedes Championships at La Costa Resort and Spa in Carlsbad. Figuring his mother could use a new luxury car to go with her new house, he told her the Mercedes was his gift to her. And why not? Cultita had devoted her life to her son, and that devotion had played a critical role in elevating him to some rare air. 2 weeks earlier, on his 21st birthday, Tiger had received the ultimate gift. Sports Illustrated had put him on the cover of its year-end issue, naming him the 1996 Sportsman of the Year, the youngest athlete ever to win the honor. Tiger hadn't been the only world-class athlete to make his professional debut in 1996. 18-year-old Kobe Bryant joined the Los Angeles Lakers. 22-year-old Derek Jeter started with the New York Yankees, and 14-year-old Serena Williams had played in her first professional tennis tournament at the end of 1995. Each would go on to become superstars in their respective sports, but in 1996, Tiger shot past them and everyone else like a comet, instantly establishing himself as a game-changer on the PGA Tour and the most compelling athlete in America. In his first 7 tournaments, he finished 6th, 11th, 5th, 3rd, 1st, 3rd, and 1st. His top 5 finishes in his last 5 tournaments were unheard of for an experienced pro, never mind a rookie. He led the tour in driving average, 302.8 yards, birdies per round, and eagle frequency, averaging 1 every 57 holes. After just 7 events, he had catapulted to 24th on the tour's money list. Tiger also instantly began changing the cultural norms of the game. Overnight crowd sizes at tournaments doubled and tripled thanks in large part to an infusion of minorities of all ages and swarms of youths of all races who had suddenly become interested in golf. The PGA Tour's television ratings went through the roof, and Tiger had single-handedly shoved the NFL and the NBA off the front page of the sports section, prompting seasoned sports writers to ask in print, "Is this really happening?" But Tiger had also become a household name in the pages of news publications like Time, Newsweek, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. It seemed like he was making history on a daily basis. Even longtime tour pros were admitting publicly that he looked like the greatest golfer in the game. Unquestionably, Tiger's arrival was the most successful debut in the history of golf, and he'd started the new year by picking up right where he left off, winning the first PGA Tour event of the 1997 season. Maybe Nike was right after all. Perhaps the golf world wasn't ready for Tiger. But as he sat in his mother's house that Monday morning in January, Tiger faced expectations that went far beyond his sport. He'd started the 1997 season with his 3rd PGA Tour victory, yet it had been expected. Being named Sportsman of the Year, like so many other aspects of his life, came with a downside, even greater expectations. When Sports Illustrated selected Tiger for the coveted honor, the magazine asked senior writer Gary Smith to author the story. Smith had no background or interest in golf, per se. His expertise was crafting penetrating human interest profiles. Toward the end of 1996, Smith spent a little over a week following Tiger on the tour and talking to him about his life. But his perception of Tiger really took shape when he talked to Tiger's father. "Tiger will do more than any other man in history to change the course of humanity," Earl told Smith. Intrigued, Smith asked the logical follow-up. Was Earl referring to sports history? Did he mean more than Joe Louis, Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali, and Arthur Ashe? "More than any of them. Because he's more charismatic, more educated, more prepared for this than anyone," Earl said. "Anyone?" Smith asked. "What about Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, or Buddha?" "Yes, because he has a larger forum than any of them," Earl said. "Because he's playing a sport that's international. Because he's qualified through his ethnicity to accomplish miracles. He's the bridge between the East and the West. There is no limit because he has the guidance. I don't know yet exactly what form this will take, but he is the chosen one. He'll have the power to impact nations, not people, nations. The world is just getting a taste of his power." Smith's story, The Chosen One, would go down in the annals of sports journalism as one of the most heartfelt cautionary profiles of a modern-day athlete. It defined Tiger Woods as the rare athlete to establish himself immediately as the dominant figure in sport. But it also raised a haunting question. Who will win, the machine or the youth who had just entered its maw? A maw, of course, is the jaws or throat of a voracious animal. And nobody fed the beast quite like Earl Dennison Woods. In a Sports Illustrated profile that should have celebrated his son's historic debut, Earl used the pages of the sports industry's leading publication to pile more impossible expectations on Tiger than had any previous parent in the history of sports. Unlike the other pushy parents behind so many talented athletes, Earl wasn't satisfied with Tiger reaching the top of his sport. He wanted his son to eclipse mankind's most prominent spiritual leaders. From the time he was old enough to walk, Tiger had been told by his parents that he was different, special, chosen, a genius, and he had been treated accordingly. Through his adolescent years, he had never worked a day in his life other than on his golf game, never mowed lawns, delivered newspapers, or pumped gas, nor did he do household chores. He wasn't expected to take out the trash, do the dishes, or cook for himself. He was so pampered that he had never even had a babysitter, not once. All of this was due to the fact that his parents thought he was going to do incredible things on the golf course. Once he did them, then and only then would he be able to do what his father had constantly told him he was born to do, change the world. For years, Tiger had internalized the pressure that came with such outsized expectations, but Earl had upped the ante by making his grandiose pronouncements in Sports Illustrated. Tiger was often put in awkward situations by things his father said. In this instance, sports writers familiar with the family dynamic were saying that the old man had finally gone too far, that he was off the rails. Some were snickering, others genuinely felt bad for Tiger. His swing coach, Butch Harmon, was outright fed up, insisting, "Earl is getting out of control." But Tiger stood by Earl, responding the way he always did, by internalizing and accepting. "None of this is scary," he told himself. "I can handle the burden." He'd been programmed to think that way, to never admit to being weak. In all those times when his father put him through hell, using prisoner of war training tactics to toughen him up and beating him down with insulting names and racist taunts, Tiger had never once uttered the code word, enough, nor would he utter that word now. Rather, he fell back on what he knew. "I am the toughest golfer mentally," Tiger told Smith. That was Tiger's mindset when he exited his mother's home that January morning and climbed into the back of a limousine, where 43-year-old Charles P. Pierce was waiting. It surprised Pierce that Tiger was alone. There was no PR person from IMG to monitor the interview. Pierce was writing yet another profile of Tiger, this one to accompany Tiger's appearance on the cover of an upcoming issue of GQ. Every bit as much a journalistic heavyweight as Gary Smith, Charlie Pierce was a prolific writer with a reputation for iconoclastic insight and irreverent prose. He had already made up his mind that Tiger possessed the most perfect golf swing ever witnessed, that he was the best golfer under age 30 who had ever lived, and that he was going to win more major championships than Jack Nicklaus. But not for a second did Pierce believe a word Earl Woods had said in the Sports Illustrated article, in particular the stuff about knowing God's mind. Or as Pierce put it, "I do not believe that Earl Woods could find God's mind with a pack of bloodhounds and Thomas Aquinas leading the way." Tiger knew a lot less about Pierce than Pierce knew about him. But when Pierce brought up the Sports Illustrated piece during the limo ride to a studio in Long Beach, Tiger downplayed it. "I feel that the SI article went a little too deep," he said. "As writers go, you guys try to dig deep into something that's really nothing." During the photo shoot, Tiger was assisted by four beautiful women who were there to dress him in stylish outfits. While a fashion photographer clicked away, Tiger had fun with the flirtatious women, telling them jokes. "The little rascals are at school," he told them, "and the teacher wants them to use specific words and sentences. The first word is love," Spanky answers, "I love dogs." "The second word is respect," Alfalfa answers, "I respect how much Spanky loves dogs." "The third word is dictate." There's a pause in the room. Finally, Buckwheat puts up his hand. "Hey, Darla," says Buckwheat. "How my dictate?" The women laughed. The flirting escalated. Tiger told more jokes, and Pierce wrote it all down. As the shoot wound to a close, Tiger asked the women why lesbians always get where they're going faster than two gay guys. Then he answered his own question. "Because lesbians are always going 69. More laughter. More note-taking by Pierce. "Hey," Tiger said, looking at Pierce, "you can't write this." "Too late," Pierce said. Even that drew laughs, but Pierce wasn't kidding. During the limo ride back to his mother's house, Tiger, yawning, looked at Pierce and asked, "Well, what did you think of the shoot?" Pierce didn't say what he really thought, that Tiger was the most charismatic athlete alive, and that his image on the cover of GQ would get him laid 296 times over the coming year. Instead, he was more interested in hearing what Tiger thought of it. "The key to it is to give them a time and stick to it," Tiger said. "If I say I'm there for an hour, I'm there, on time, for an hour. If they ask for more, I say, hell fuck no, and I'm out of there." Pierce noted that too. He noted everything Tiger said while they were together. None of it seemed to faze Tiger, who had places to go, people to meet, appearances to make. Even at midnight, Tiger drew a crowd. When he and his mother touched down in Bangkok, Thailand in early February, the airport was overrun with fans. Four of the country's five television stations broadcast the moment live. Nike sponsored the trip, thinking Tiger's presence in the Asian golf market was a potential goldmine. Just for appearing in the Asian Honda Classic, Tiger received $448,000. He picked up another $48,000 for winning by 10 strokes. While in his mother's homeland, he had a private audience with the country's prime minister, met with prominent business leaders, and was toasted at various private parties and receptions before taking off for Melbourne, where he pocketed another $300,000 for appearing in the Australian Masters. By PGA Tour standards in 1997, the sums for these non-tour appearances were staggering. So was the travel. It was all part of building Tiger's global brand. Earl didn't make the trip to Thailand. After his episode in Tulsa, doctors performed an angiogram, which revealed that he had a number of damaged or blocked arteries. In addition to being told to make some serious lifestyle changes that included a new diet and giving up cigarettes and alcohol, Earl was scheduled for triple bypass surgery. The procedure took place at UCLA Medical Center at the end of February, and Tiger cleared his schedule to be there. Due to complications, Earl was in the intensive care unit where he was heavily medicated. Tiger was watching the heart monitor one day when Earl flatlined. He told me later that in that moment he felt a surge of warmth, and he felt he was walking into the light, Tiger recalled, but he decided he didn't want to go to the light. For the first time, Tiger caught a glimpse of what life would be like without his father. Although he didn't say anything to Earl when he made a full recovery, Earl knew what his son was feeling. Tiger is not one to over-emotionalize things, he said shortly after he left the hospital. Neither am I. We don't have to. We just touch, and it's all said. Shortly after his return to the tour in March, Tiger was at the Bay Hill Invitational about to play the second round when he first saw himself on the cover of GQ. The picture was good. He was smiling and looking dapper in a sharp suit and tie. But the headline was ominous. The coming of Tiger Woods, sports' next messiah. This might not be good, he thought. He opened the magazine and saw the title of the story, The Man, Amen. Beneath it in big bold letters were the words, In the Book of St. Earl of the Woods, let us now turn to the next chapter, verse 1997, in which the presumed messiah, halo swoosh and all, is revealed to be, gasp, a 21-year-old kid. Unable to remember everything he had told Pierce, it had been 2 months since the interview, a virtual eternity in Tiger's fever-pitched life. He started reading. The piece opened with an irreverent joke, followed by a scene from the limo ride back to Tiger's mother's house. During the limo ride, Tiger had engaged in conversation with the limo driver. What I can't figure out, Tiger said to the driver, is why so many good-looking women hang around baseball and basketball. Is it because, you know, people always say that, like, black guys have big dicks? This is definitely not good. Tiger couldn't believe that Pierce had put that in his story. Those words were spoken to the limo driver, not to the reporter. All his off-color jokes were in the story, too, along with an acknowledgement by Pierce that Tiger's jokes about blacks, gays, lesbians, and buckwheat asking a girl how his dick tasted were no different from those told by most 21-year-olds sitting around a keg in a frat house on a Saturday night. Then Tiger read this line about himself. He tells jokes that are going to become something else entirely when they appear in this magazine because he is not most 21-year-olds. Feeling like he'd been sucker-punched, Tiger scolded himself. How could I have been so stupid, he thought. Within 24 hours, IMG issued a press release. It's no secret that I'm 21 years old and that I'm naive about the motives of certain ambitious writers, Wood said in the statement. The article proves that, and I don't see any reason for anyone to pay $3 to find that out. It's easy to laugh it off as juvenile and petty, except for the attacks on my father. I don't understand the cheap shots against him. Pierce's piece had exposed the folly in the narrative Earl had constructed for his son. It also wounded Tiger. Already suspicious of the media, Tiger saw the GQ piece as proof positive that journalists could not be trusted. Rather than re-examining his own behavior or the role that IMG had played in setting up the ground rules that had left him alone with Pierce, Tiger doubled down on his determination to wall himself off. The experience cemented the policy Earl had been advising all along when it came to dealing with reporters. Just answer the questions, never say a word more. Going forward, Tiger would not veer off script again. There would be no more joking around, no more letting anyone with a pen or a microphone remotely close to his real thoughts or feelings. Tiger also seemed to maintain a mental list of reporters that he perceived were out to get him, an enemies list of sorts. Charlie Pierce no doubt joined Feinstein at the top. For Pierce, it didn't matter, he didn't cover golf. But for all the journalists covering the PGA Tour, the GQ piece changed the dynamic. It validated the contempt that Erlen Kaltita harbored toward anyone who dared to write critically about their son. No one understood this better than Jamie Diaz. His parents hated it when Tiger was criticized, Diaz said. That was, in their mind, the press being against them. Earl fostered that, and Tita took that view too. She was very black and white about who was on her side. She would tell me, you cross me, and that's it. There was always a guillotine with the Woods family. Tiger's new home inside the gates of Isleworth in Windermere, Florida, was a welcome refuge. In addition to the privacy, one of the things Tiger liked most about his new address was its proximity to Mark O'Mara. He and his wife Alicia and their two children, Michelle, aged 10, and Sean, aged 9, lived a few doors down from Tiger. Overnight, Tiger became the fifth member of the O'Mara family. He spent more time with them than he did in his own home. A family man and a consummate pro, Mark O'Mara had a profound impact on Tiger, taking him under his wing the same way Payne Stewart had mentored O'Mara back when he was a fresh face on the tour himself. They were, in many respects, an odd couple. White and balding at 40 years of age, O'Mara was practically old enough to be Tiger's father. His idea of a good time was finding a productive fishing hole, yet Tiger did everything with him, watched sports on television, went to the movies, and even went fishing. Primarily, though, they played a lot of golf together at the Isleworth Golf and Country Club, where Tiger gave O'Mara a daily dose of his competitive juices as they battled in one practice round after another. There wasn't much O'Mara could teach Tiger about golf, but by being around O'Mara so much, Tiger could see the important role family played in Mark's career. Alicia and the children were an integral part of O'Mara's success. It was clear to Woods that O'Mara was an exceptional player. The guy had won tournaments all over the world, but O'Mara had never managed to win a major championship. One day, Tiger asked him why. He wanted to know the factors that had kept O'Mara from beating the best when it mattered the most. O'Mara said he wasn't sure, but playing around Tiger had kindled a competitive fire in him. He wanted what Tiger had, a killer instinct and the confidence to close out a win. Tiger, on the other hand, wanted what O'Mara already had, a beautiful wife with blonde hair, two kids, a Porsche, and the big luxury home that dwarfed his current two-bedroom villa. From Tiger's vantage point, off the course, O'Mara had it all. He had certainly chosen well when he married Alicia. Besides being one of the most attractive wives on the PGA Tour, she created an ideal environment at home, and she welcomed Tiger into it. Even when Mark wasn't around, Tiger would routinely open the front door and yell, "What's for dinner?" She always set an extra place at the table for him. The O'Mara home was very different, much more casual than the one Tiger had grown up in. Alicia and the kids often wore bathing suits around the house, going back and forth from the pool. They ordered from Domino's. Everyone went to the movies together. Unlike the tightly wound environment of Tiger's childhood, the O'Mara house was laid back and fun, and no one expected anything from him. He was free to be himself. On the Friday before the start of the 61st Masters, Tiger and O'Mara played a practice round at Isleworth. They made a friendly wager on the match. Shooting 10 under par through 1 9-hole stretch, Tiger was talking shit and having fun getting deeper and deeper into O'Mara's wallet. With 6 holes to play, Tiger drove a tee shot down the fairway, and a massive white plume appeared in the distance. O'Mara knew what it was. The Space Shuttle Columbia had just launched, but Tiger had never witnessed a launch. A chill swept over him as he took a seat in his golf cart and watched the boosters come off. As far back as early childhood, he had been interested in the space program. He'd read about NASA and its missions. Awed, he stared into space, contemplating the scientists who were behind the shuttle launch. What an accomplishment, he thought. Here I am playing golf while 7 astronauts have just taken off in a space shuttle. He suddenly felt small by comparison. O'Mara couldn't help marveling as he watched Tiger. Here was a 21-year-old kid who was about to play in his first major championship tournament as a professional, with virtually every golf writer in the country picking him to win. Moreover, like it or not, Woods was carrying a huge social burden heading into the Masters, where the co-founder of the tournament had once said, "As long as I'm alive, golfers will be white and caddies will be black." It wasn't until 1975 that Lee Elder played in the Masters, the first black golfer to do so. He endured taunts and voices from the gallery saying things like, he shouldn't be here. And it wasn't until 1990 that Augusta National finally allowed a black man to join the club. Only 7 years had passed since then, and the hype Tiger had generated was unprecedented. And yet Tiger was looking into the sky, fascinated by space travel, wondering about a shuttle that would transport a satellite into orbit around the Earth. Exhilarated, Tiger stepped out of his golf cart and played six scintillating holes to finish the round with a final score of 59. It was the best round he had ever played, and O'Meara sensed that he had witnessed the prelude to history. A couple of days later, they flew together to Augusta. On the short flight, Tiger turned to O'Meara. Do you think it's possible to win the Grand Slam? He asked. O'Meara hesitated, sensing where Tiger was going with this line of questioning. The Grand Slam was golf's holy grail. No one, not even Nicklaus or Hogan, had come close to winning the Masters, the U.S. Open, the British Open, and the PGA Championship in a single season. Unrealistic, O'Meara said finally. Tiger didn't say much more on the subject. He wasn't interested in whether it was realistic. He was driven by the impossible. He wanted the Holy Grail, and he believed he could get it. It had been only 6 weeks since his triple bypass, and Earl was still on strict orders not to travel. But he was determined not to miss what he believed would be Tiger's greatest performance to date, and so he decided to go to Augusta. By the time he arrived, he was worn out and ailing, but he was there. Staying in a house with Coltita and Tiger and a couple of Tiger's friends, Earl spent most of his time in bed, which is where he was on the night before the first round of play. Concerned more about his father than himself, Tiger grabbed three balls and a putter and went to Earl's bedside. Then he got into his putting stance and asked his father if he noticed anything. Your hands are too low, Earl said. Lift them up. Get that little arch in your hands like you always do. Tiger was no longer a little boy in need of his father's instruction. At 21, he was the most talented golfer on earth. What he needed was to feel the bond with his father that had been forged through countless hours of playing golf together at the Navy course back home. He could visualize the trees there, and he remembered the quiet evenings that were connected to golfing with Pop. The next morning, April 10th, 1997, as Tiger approached the first tee, it was already obvious that the 61st Masters would be a game changer. Walking alongside him was his new caddy, Mike Fluff Cowan, sporting long gray hair and a bushy white mustache that made him look like the actor Wilford Brimley. In every imaginable way, Tiger and Fluff were an unlikely pair. Tiger listened to R&B and rap, favored perfectly pressed clothes, and lived in a gated community. Fluff worshipped the Grateful Dead, wore frumpy, shaggy outfits, and was something of a vagabond known to have lived in his car in earlier years. They had come together after Tiger won his third U.S. amateur in August of the previous year. Tiger had to scramble to find a caddy before his debut at the Greater Milwaukee Open, and he called Cowan. Despite being relatively unknown on the tour, Cowan certainly had bona fides as a caddy. After starring on the golf team at William Penn College in Iowa, he had briefly returned home to Auburn, Maine, and worked as an assistant pro at a country club before finding his way to tour as a caddy in 1976. There he hooked up with Peter Jacobson, a telegenic star who won six PGA events over a nearly 20-year period with Fluff on his back. The two of them were quite close, but Jacobson had hurt his back earlier in the summer of 1996 and was sidelined. Tiger told Cowan he was turning pro and asked if he would caddy for him during his final seven tournaments of the year. Fluff agreed to help, but only until Jacobson was healthy enough to tee it up again. Tiger admired Cowan's loyalty and agreed, but while carrying the bag for Tiger at Milwaukee, Fluff had one holy shit moment after another as Tiger hit off the tee. He likened it to being next to a NASA launch pad. By the time Tiger had gotten his first two tour victories, Cowan realized that Woods was making history, and he had the best seat in the house. He called Jacobson, thanked him profusely for having treated him like a king for two decades, and told Tiger he would be his permanent caddy. It was a decision that would thrust Cowan into the spotlight and turn him into the most popular caddy on the PGA Tour and make him a part of history. The sight of a young black golfer and an older white caddy standing on the first tee at Augusta was a complete role reversal, a vivid illustration that everything was changing. Tiger was so amped up that he drove his first tee shot left into the trees. He started the 61st Masters with a bogey, and things unraveled from there. He bogeyed the fourth and fifth holes, too. Angry, he questioned himself. What is going on? and on 9 he bogeyed yet again. Through the opening 9 holes, he shot a 4 over par 40. Feeling the weight of everyone's eyes upon him, Tiger walked off the 9th green furious and bewildered. In the back of his mind, he knew that skeptics were already predicting the tournament was over for him. The highest score ever recorded on the first 9 by a Masters winner was 38. Tiger was in trouble. "We've only played 9 holes," Cowan told him. "There was plenty of time to turn things around." One thing Tiger appreciated most about Fluff was his go-with-the-flow approach. He always seemed to know what to say and what not to say. At that moment, the last thing Tiger needed was additional tension. Silent, he ignored the crowds that were urging him on as he walked toward the 10th tee. Deep inside his own head, trying to figure out what he was doing wrong, he drew strength from the prisoner of war techniques his father had put him through when he was 11 and 12 years old. It had felt so brutal back then, but Earl had told him time and time again that if he was going to become the great black hope of golf, he had to learn to block out any feelings of insecurity. Faced with the prospect of crumbling halfway through the opening round, Tiger zeroed in on the task at hand. On the 10th tee, he pulled his 2-iron from his bag. Fluff liked the selection. Then Tiger hit a blistering shot down the fairway. There! That was it. The same feeling he'd had at Isleworth the week before when he'd shot 59. With a sudden uptick in his pace, Tiger walked to his ball in the fairway and with an 8-iron hit it to within 15 feet of the cup before closing out the hole with a birdie putt. Okay, this is it, he told himself. I'll be fine. His mental approach had made a complete reversal. On the back 9, he shot a 6 under 30, ending the day in 4th place, just 3 strokes behind the leader. The mental training for golf that my dad had put me through proved itself during that short walk from the 9th green to the 10th tee, he would later say, and was completely vindicated by the way I played on the back 9. Immediately after the first round, Tiger went to the practice range. He wanted to ingrain the feel of swing he'd had on the back 9 for the next round. Fluff Cowan and Butch Harmon watched him hit one perfect shot after another. Neither of them said a word. They didn't have to. There were still 3 rounds to play, but the 61st Masters was won in that lonely walk from the 9th green to the 10th tee on Thursday. From that moment on, Tiger ran away from the field. On day 2, he took sole possession of first place with an eagle on 13 that sent a thunderous roar cascading across Augusta. He shot 66 on the day. Then on day 3, he shot 65, missing only 1 green and 1 fairway, giving him the largest 54-hole lead in the history of the Masters. He was 9 shots ahead of the field. He looked as though he were playing against old men. As he walked the course, he was greeted by screams of, "Tiger! Tiger!" from waves of young fans who had never heard of Bobby Jones, Byron Nelson, or Ben Hogan. Consciously trying not to look anyone directly in the eye, he tipped his cap to what seemed like one giant blur of thousands of faces. He had never dreamt it would feel so magical. On the night before the final round, Tiger was back at the house contemplating what was ahead. A 9-shot lead with 1 round to go, he thought. It would be a nightmare to lose such a lead. Only 1 year earlier, Greg Norman had melted down in the final round, blowing a 6-shot lead to lose the Masters. If he lost a 9-shot lead, Tiger knew, the failure would follow him the rest of his career. He couldn't let that happen. After everyone else had gone to bed, Tiger went to Earl's bedroom to check on him. Earl was exhausted, but Tiger knew he would find him awake. Ever since Tiger was a kid, they had always talked through the final round of a tournament before going to sleep. And more than ever, Tiger wanted to hear what his father had to say. The last 18 holes, Earl told him, would be the most difficult he had ever faced. His message was direct. Don't get lackadaisical. The next day, Earl was too weak to leave the house. Knowing his father would be watching on television, Tiger wanted nothing more than to make him and his mother proud. But to do that, he needed to create some emotional distance. I need to be that cold-blooded assassin, he told himself. When he arrived in Augusta, the magnitude of the moment sank in. He was about to become the youngest golfer to win the Masters. Could this really happen? He asked himself. It was an invigorating question, one that seemed to have gripped the entire country. A record 44 million Americans tuned in to watch the final round of the Masters on CBS. That represented a 65% increase over the previous year. Wearing a red T-shirt with a white Nike swoosh, Tiger walked up to the first tee shortly after 3 p.m. and entered his bubble of concentration. He remained there until he retrieved his ball from the ninth hole and began the short walk toward the 10th tee. This time it felt very different from the way it had 3 days earlier. With 63 holes behind him and just 9 to go, he had built an insurmountable lead. As he approached the 10th tee, he allowed his mind to go to his dad, whom he visualized back at the house watching on television. He thought of his mother, who he knew was walking the course as she had done for just about every tournament round he had played since he was a boy. With the two of them, he had sat in the living room at age 10, watching Jack Nicklaus win the 1986 Masters on television, and dreamed of doing that. Here he was, 11 years later, and Jack Nicklaus was now elbowing his way through the masses of spectators trying to get a glimpse of Tiger. The dream was fulfilled. The only question remaining was whether he could break the tournament record for the lowest score of all time. No matter how weak he felt, Earl wasn't going to miss the moment. Rallying, he got out of bed, dressed, and had one of Tiger's friends drive him to the course in time to see the finish. He was waiting at the 18th green, where he watched Tiger on a small television monitor as he made his way up the 18th fairway. Only 15 months removed from being a teenager, Tiger walked through two massive columns of fans who closed in on him as he made his way to the green. It was an intoxicating rush to be on the edge of history. His final shot, a 5-footer for par, sent the gallery into a frenzy as Tiger reacted with a right-arm uppercut. He hugged Cowan, then made a beeline for his ailing father and threw his arms around him. Coltita, beaming with pride, watched her son and husband embrace. "We made it," Earl sobbed. "We made it. We made it." Tiger didn't want to let go. "I love you, son," Earl whispered, "and I'm so proud of you." Those words were so rare and so cherished that Tiger wept in his father's arms. Finally, Coltita joined the embrace. The three of them were united, expressing affection. It may have been the happiest moment of Tiger Woods' life. Chapter 12. Mania. Tiger's record performance at Augusta ranked as one of the most phenomenal moments in sports history, right up there alongside Cassius Clay upsetting Sonny Liston for the heavyweight boxing championship. Bob Beamon shattering the world long jumping record by nearly 2 feet when he leaped 29 feet 4 3/8 inches to win the gold medal at the Mexico City Olympics, and Secretariat winning the Triple Crown with his victory at the Belmont Stakes by an incredible 31 lengths. The sheer number of records Tiger had tied or set was mind-boggling. Youngest winner at 21 years, 3 months, and 14 days, old record 23 years, 4 days by Steve Ballesteros in 1980. Lowest 72-hole total, 270. Old record, 271 by Jack Nicklaus in 1965 and Raymond Floyd in 1976. Largest margin of victory, 12 strokes. Old record, 9 strokes by Jack Nicklaus in 1965. Lowest final 54 holes, 200. Old record, 202 by Johnny Miller in 1975. Lowest first 54 holes, 201, tying the record set by Raymond Floyd in 1976. Lowest middle 36 holes, 131. Old record, 132 by Nick Price in 1986. Most under par on back 9, 16 under. Old record, 12 under by Arnold Palmer in 1962. Largest lead after 54 holes, 9 strokes. Old record, 8 strokes by Raymond Floyd in 1976. More important than all the official records was another achievement. Tiger was the first golfer of African-American heritage to win a major golf championship. That single accomplishment, more than anything else, would change his life in ways that were impossible to prepare for. Those changes began as soon as he stepped off the course at Augusta. Moments after signing his scorecard, Tiger spotted Lee Elder. Now 62, Elder had been 40 years old when he became the first black man to play in the Masters, the year Tiger was born. Stopping to hug Elder, Tiger whispered in his ear, "Thanks for making this possible." Elder melted into tears as he watched Tiger walk off to Butler Cabin for the traditional televised presentation of the green jacket. Grinning, Tiger held out his arms as Nick Faldo, the previous year's champion, slipped the coveted sports coat on him. The process was repeated moments later at the victory ceremony on the practice green behind the first tee, where Tiger noticed the abundance of black people from the Augusta staff who had left their posts and assembled on the lawn and the veranda on the second floor. It struck Tiger then that the barrier had been broken. Overwhelmed, he took the microphone and looked at the vast audience. "I've always dreamt of winning the Masters and coming up 18 like I did with the lead," he said. "I never thought this far through the ceremony." The audience laughed and a huge smile swept across Tiger's face. "Last night my pop and I were talking," he continued. He said, "Son, this will probably be one of the hardest rounds you've ever had to play in your life. If you just go out there and be yourself, it will be one of the most rewarding rounds of golf you've ever played in your life." And he was right. Security guards then escorted Woods to the media center where a throng of reporters were waiting. En route, Tiger got word that President Bill Clinton had called Augusta and was waiting on the line for him. That was his life now, a call from the president. Tiger ducked into a little room near the press area and listened as the president congratulated him on his win. He also invited Tiger to be his special guest at Shea Stadium. To mark the 50-year anniversary of Jackie Robinson's breaking the color barrier in Major League Baseball, he was being honored on Tuesday night during a Dodgers-Mets game. Robinson's widow, Rachel Robinson, would be there. It would be an amazing moment, the president figured, for the young golfer who broke the color barrier at Augusta to be on hand to pay tribute to the man whom many viewed as the most important African-American athlete in history. President Clinton even offered to send an Air Force plane to pick Tiger up. Everything was happening so fast. Tiger breezed into the interview room wearing his green jacket, then quickly changed into another jacket and tie for the winner's dinner at the Augusta National Clubhouse. Earl went back to the house to rest, and Tiger went to the dinner with his mother and Hughes Norton. Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer rose to their feet along with all the other past winners and their spouses as Tiger entered the dining room. At the back of the room, all the black staff, the cooks and waiters and busboys, set down their dishes and trays to clap louder and longer than the dinner guests. Bridging two worlds, Tiger paused, acknowledged the staff, and took his seat at the head table beneath a portrait of President Eisenhower. By the time the dinner ended, Augusta looked like a ghost town. The tens of thousands of spectators were gone, and it was hard to find signs that only hours earlier it had been the site of one of the biggest sporting events in American history. Tiger piled into a Cadillac courtesy car with his mom and his friends, popped in a CD by the hip-hop group Quad City DJs, cranked up Come On and Ride It, the train, to full blast, and drove down Magnolia Lane with the windows down. No Masters winner had ever left Augusta in such style. The next morning, Tiger woke up with a headache and flew to South Carolina for the grand opening of an official all-star cafe in Myrtle Beach. It was an obligation that had come with the new sponsorship deal he'd recently signed with Planet Hollywood, which owned the cafes. After being mobbed by fans, Tiger huddled with Hughes Norton, who had been deluged with phone messages. Most of them were from corporations seeking sponsorship deals with Tiger. Fast food chains, beverage companies, consumer products manufacturers, breakfast cereal makers, credit card companies, car companies. The list went on and on. With so many top brands now clamoring for Tiger, IMG urged him to expand his portfolio. Reluctantly, he authorized Norton to pursue a deal with American Express and said he wanted a deal with a watchmaker, a car company, and a video game company. That was it. No fast food companies, no sugary sodas. Most of the other messages Norton had to discuss with Tiger were from the media. David Letterman and Jay Leno wanted him to appear. Tiger said no. A bunch of newspapers and magazines wanted to talk to him. Tiger said no to them, too. The big question was what to do about President Clinton's invitation to join him in New York the following evening. It wasn't every day that the leader of the free world offered to send an Air Force plane for you. But Tiger had planned to fly to Cancun for a much-needed escape. It would have been easy enough to delay his departure by a day to attend the Robinson event, but Tiger took it as a slight that the president had failed to include him in the earlier round of invites that went out to other notable black athletes. So, his attitude toward Clinton, according to a source close to Tiger, was simple. Screw him. Tiger wasn't changing his plans, not even for the president. Norton said he would handle it, and Tiger boarded a plane for Mexico, where he hung out on the beach for 4 days, eating and drinking and celebrating with a couple of buddies from high school and college. He was off the grid, but his fame was sweeping the globe. His Masters victory was being hailed in Europe, Asia, and Australia. At the same time, his decision to skip the Jackie Robinson ceremony was causing an uproar in the United States. Norton was fielding testy calls from journalists, such as this exchange with John Feinstein. "Are you kidding me?" Feinstein said. "He's tired," Norton said. "He's always tired. This is the President of the United States and Jackie Robinson's widow. You go." He doesn't see it that way. He sees it as a last-second invitation, and he had plans. Last second? He only won the Masters on Sunday. Were they supposed to know in advance he was going to win? No golf writer had gotten under Tiger's skin more than Feinstein. His criticism of Earl in his columns and on Nightline had roiled Woods more than anything that anyone had ever written about him or his golf game, and Earl was so furious that it was all he could do to refrain from taking matters into his own hands and getting physical with Feinstein. Norton used intimidation of a different sort.